The hour of 10:15 having arrived, I will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We're going to switch around a little bit on the agenda here. We're going to go with House File 404 first. Chair Carlson, if you could please join us at the table here, at the front table. And then it would be my intention to go to the Grunhagen bill, the Swedzinski bill, David's House File 53, since there are folks from out of town to testify. And then if we have time, we'll look at House File 1005, Tax Reciprocity. Chair Carlson, welcome to your committee. If you could please explain your bill. And before we get started, are there any, and we will continue to go through, even though we don't have a quorum, and we'll make proper motions when we do have a quorum. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 404 or with concerns thereof? You know what that means, Chair Carlson.
You want me to be brief? It's warp probably speed. What that means.
Warp speed. Chair Carlson, take all the time you need.
Mr. Chairman, you know, as sometimes happens when we serve here, you're contacted by a constituent that has a concern or an issue. And I was contacted by a constituent that mentioned or wrote me an email that we do mandate that you have child safety seats by law. And he said, being that we mandate that by law, he felt it should be exempt from the sales tax. And one of the points that he made and others that I've since talked about is that car seats are sometimes quite expensive. So after he contacted me, I did a little research. I stopped at a couple of discount stores because I'm at that stage where I'm a grandpa. And I hadn't recently bought any car seats, although my wife reminded me that a few years ago we bought some for our grandchildren. But our grandkids are now, by and large, older. But at any rate, I was quite surprised when I took a look at what they cost. For example, with one of our local discount stores, I have an ad here. The lowest cost one in the ad is $199, and the highest one is $329. I went to another discount store, and they did have one that sold for $49. I'm quite honestly not sure if that met the qualifications for safety or not. It may have been more a booster seat. But they quickly jumped to $100 and more and up to $300 at that particular store. So I looked online as well, and so it's fairly common that they will approach, if you get a good one, the neighborhood of $250, $289, $329 in the case of the one ad that I have here that was in Sunday's paper. So, Mr. Chairman, I decided to introduce a bill. I thought that the constituent made a good point. And then when we had a hearing the other day in another committee, one of the committee members pointed out, well, there are families that have to have more than one car seat. And you might have to have two or maybe even three if your children are young. And, you know, then the multiplier effect that can become pretty expensive. And when she reminded the committee that you might have to have more than one, I said, well, I hadn't thought of this, but a year ago my niece had twins. So right from the get-go, you know, if you get a good car seat, you're probably talking easily $600. So that's the purpose of the bill. It would try to help some of the younger families that are starting out and starting their family to at least get a little break on the sales tax if they purchase a car seat. So with that, I'll stop, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Any questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say that I think this is a great bill. And, you know, people may not be as aware that we have passed laws that you have to go up to booster seats. And, I mean, you have to change the seat as the child grows to have it be appropriately safe for them. So it's not just a... I think in the old days we used to think it was a one-time expenditure, but you actually end up buying several as they grow.
Any other questions for Chair Carlson? With that, Representative Earhart. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if there's a used market or slightly used or something. It sounds to me like the size of this is a good business for somebody to be gathering up the pieces that have been used and put them back on the market, renovate them and put them back on the market. Does anybody know that's the case?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, there are probably some that I sold used, but because an infant seat shouldn't be used after it's been in an accident, there isn't a big market for secondary uses.
Chair Earhart?
No.
Okay. Any other questions for Chair Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, on that point, I did, I shouldn't say research, I had a conversation that, you know, some of the stores where they sell donated goods, it might be a store policy, but they have a policy that they don't sell used ones because there'd be some risk that they might not meet the safety standards, and therefore I suppose they're concerned that there might be a liability or something, but that may be simply a store policy. Places like ARC, you know, that they have donated goods and so on, they just don't resell them.
Any other questions for Chair Carlson? Members, we do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. And before we get back on House File 404, Representative Simonson. He's not here. Representative Petersburg moves the minutes of February 19, 2015. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Item next, Chair Carlson moves House File 404 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Chair Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Item next, we will go to House File 377. Representative Wills.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 377 for consideration.
Representative Wills moves House File 377, so it is before us. Mm-hmm. Representative Grunhagen, to your bill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this bill does, by the way, I've got an amendment, so I'd like to get the bill in order, an A2 amendment.
Okay, we have the A2 amendment. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. To get the bill in the shape the author would like, Representative Kosnick moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion barely prevails. Okay, so with that, I'll ask the same question again here. Is there anyone from the audience that wish to testify for House File 377 as amended or with concerns? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, excuse me. We do have a couple folks here who'd like to come
up. Yeah, I have
why don't you all kind of come down here so I can see who we're dealing with. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll be brief, won't they? I'm sure they will be.
Brevity is the key to effectiveness, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone that is going to be testifying with concerns? Okay, I think we know what that means. Okay.
Okay.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose of the bill is to create a state tax deduction for charitable care for doctors, dentists, chiropractors, and medical professionals in general. It's a way to incentivize treatment for the least, for people who are disadvantaged and least able to provide either insurance for themselves or to be able to pay for their medical bills. I have a lot of support on this. We'll start out with the Minnesota Dental Association, Jacob Milner.
Please state your name and who represents the record, please. And before we get into that testimony, I don't believe I asked for a testimony from the department on the Carlson bill. Are we okay with that? And do you need to testify on this one? On this one? How about on the Carlson one? You're okay. Okay. Okay, please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jacob Milner, and I am with the Minnesota Dental Association, and I will be brief. I just wanted to say that we do support House File 377. As most of you know, Minnesota has a pretty severe dental access issue, the main thrust of which we believe is our reimbursement rates, which are right at the bottom of the country. We view this bill as a step in the right direction. It obviously won't help with reimbursement rates, but we do know that it will hopefully incentivize more charity care. Dentists are already doing a great deal of charity care in our state. Thousands of patients are being seen due to charity care. We shouldn't have patients necessarily rely on charity care, but we're working on that with other legislation, which you'll see soon enough. But we do support this bill because we do think that it will incentivize more access, which is something that's a good thing. So we support this bill.
Any questions for Mr. Milner? Who would like to testify next?
Yeah, Dr. Tapla.
Yes, and while he's coming up, Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the person from the Minnesota Dental Association, could you describe for me a little bit your membership? Are all dentists in the Minnesota Dental Association? What type of practitioners are included? What are the requirements for membership in the Minnesota Dental Association? And could you give me a little bit of a snapshot of exactly what kinds of charity care dentists are already providing? And if they're already providing it, already providing charity care, why... Why would we give them a tax exemption?
Mr. Miller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Ansell. The Minnesota Dental Association represents about three-quarters, less than 80% of dentists, oral surgeons in the state of Minnesota. Our membership, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, it's over 3,000 dental professionals okay. in the state of Minnesota. So it's a vast majority of dentists in the state. In terms of charity care, and I'll let Dr. Tapel, who's actually participated in these charity care events, we recently, last week, had a Give Kids a Smile program, which I think we had 600 dental offices in the state treating thousands of kids. That's, you know, issues like cleanings, sealants, you know, tooth removals, anything that needs to be done. We have a major program over the summer. It's called Mission of Mercy, which you literally see thousands of families lining up days in advance for free dental care, in which it's a two-day event, and we see about 1,000 dental volunteers, and we see thousands of adults and children, people that are getting teeth replaced, you know, so they can go to a job interview, people that have never seen a dentist for decades, kids who have real issues, who don't have access to dental. I will say, as I said earlier, Minnesota's reimbursement rate for dental for Medicaid is, for pediatric, is 50th in the country, and for adult, we're 46th or 47th, right at the bottom. There's, I think, a larger issue here, and this bill is a step in the right direction, is the way we view it.
Mr. Miller, what you mentioned, a couple days where everybody can kind of come in and get dental mm-hmm. care, what's that called again?
It's called the Mission of Mercy, Mr. Chair.
Who wrote the original bill on that?
That is, yes. Well, I think you did.
He's really good. Representative Athlett, you're on the
floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that really sounds excellent that charity care is being provided, and thanks to our esteemed chair of the committee here, he is the one who made it possible. But my dilemma here is, if this bill were to be enacted into law, we really wouldn't have charity care anymore. We'd be paying for it. The taxpayers of the state of Minnesota would be paying for it. So I question that. And wouldn't it be better if you all worked with us and worked through the system to actually improve those reimbursement rates and do it the old-fashioned way rather than with a tax exemption?
Mr. Milner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansell. I'm glad you mentioned that, because there is a bill that has been introduced in both the House and Senate that would take our reimbursement rates from the 1989 level, which we are currently at, up to 2012, back into this century at least. So we look forward to working with you on that bill.
So, Mr. Chairman, finally, so we're going to go from charity to now a double payment system. Improved reimbursement rates and an income tax exemption.
Mr. Milner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansel, I can't speak to the specifics of the bill. I don't believe, and this would be a more technical question for the author or counsel, I don't think you can get a double reimbursement on this based on the bill, the way it's set
Thank
up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So that's more of a question,
okay.
More of a technical question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's go to the next testifier, please. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Lauren Tapel. I have been a general dentist in Eagan for the past 25 years. I guess let me first be clear. We do have a dental access crisis in the state of Minnesota. And while, as has been stated, our reimbursement rates from the state remain among the lowest in the nation, this House File 377 has the potential to incentivize charitable care to the least fortunate in our state. So on behalf of myself and as a member of the Minnesota Dental Association, I would like to applaud Representative Gruenhagen for his efforts to help increase access to quality health care, including dental, because at the end of the day, that is what we're all hoping to achieve. As was stated, dentists are already providing tremendous amounts of charity care. The Minnesota Dental Association's annual Mission of Mercy, which this coming July will be at the DEC up in Duluth, so I invite any of the legislators to come up and view that event. Give Kids a Smile is an annual event, donated dental services, among other programs. But we can do more to encourage greater access to care. Speaking from my own personal experience in my office, there have been multiple instances because of a patient's circumstances that I have provided services knowing I was donating those services. Without these donations, these patients would simply have gone without the service. Being able to provide these types of services to patients in need can in many instances be life-altering. I can tell you that while I do treat patients on public programs, my office also turns away pretty much on a daily basis an average of 10, 12 calls of people seeking this type of care. We simply cannot handle more patients on these programs, mostly due to the costs we incur in having to process the paperwork involved. Dental services, like any other service, do have a cost, and knowing that we as providers would be able to deduct a portion of that cost as a charitable donation would go a long way to increase our ability to take time out of our paid schedules to do just that. Just as people get a tax deduction for a donation of goods to Goodwill, for instance, or cash to your favorite charity, this type of donation is truly no different. So I am confident that if this type of donation existed, the list of dentists, for example, who participate in donated dental services program, while currently certainly a respectable number, would surely go up. So I urge this committee to pass this legislation forward for the betterment of the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Questions for Dr. Tapel. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure of this, but I think there are many dentists that don't operate with MA. Are half the dentists will not continue doing this? Or I don't know what the percentage is, but I know several dentists that I've had the opportunity to utilize over the past few years don't do ME care.
Right.
So is this going to say you have to do it now? Or?
No. I mean, I would say that there's a few main reasons why people are not, I think, participating in the MA program. One is certainly the reimbursement rate. Mm-hmm. Two is the deluge of paperwork that comes with having to process one of these claims and, paying our staff to process these claims for, at best a 30%, reimbursement rate. By giving people the incentive to just treat the cases and then be able to receive a tax deduction in return without having to monkey with the paperwork, to be quite honest, would allow these people to see more people in their schedule as they choose.
Well, Mr. Chairman, are you suggesting that people who do not, dentists who do not use, offer this now would use it, or more of them would use it if this were passed?
I believe that's
Dr.
the case.
Dr. Tappel?
Yes, sir.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Earhart, I just respond like this. My sister works for a dentist, and he was taking about 5 to 6% of his patients under medical assistance. He just bought a practice of a retiring dentist, and he couldn't take any more than 5 to 6%. Well, they get calls every day, just like was stated here, for MA patients that they decline and turn away. Well, somebody reported him because he wasn't taking 10%. So now he takes zero, none at all. Now he can take 5 or 6%. What this bill would do for him, if he's taking zero, he could at least give out charitable care and get some type of a tax deduction or reward for doing that. So I think, just as been testified, I think access for the least fortunate in our state would actually go up in terms of dentists who can't meet the 10% threshold or don't want to meet the 10% threshold under MA, but do want to give some type of charitable care. Just one other quick example. I had a constituent in Hutchinson. He couldn't get in to see a dentist, and he didn't qualify for a number of reasons under the government programs, but his face was swelling up on one side due to infection in his teeth, and he'd go to the emergency room on a regular basis. And I was able to work and get him in to see a dentist, but it would have been nice to be able to have some type of incentive for that dentist to get some type of deduction for his charitable care.
Jerry
and I think that's what this bill is trying to do.
Jerry Hart. Okay, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're Grunhagen. it's like looking in a mirror. Representative Grunhagen.
I get why.
So, is there already provisions in law for, like, attorneys who provide pro bono care to be able to deduct that from their taxes? Or I'm thinking of, I do a fair amount of volunteering with, it's called Lego Robotics. It's not my area of competency, but a number of the other parents that volunteer are computer programmers, are engineers, you know, bringing their professional skills to working with these kids. Are they allowed to value the time, you know, at their usual rate of reimbursement and deduct that from their taxes? I think of firefighters. Historically, and I don't understand this, but historically there's been a connection between firefighters and the Muscular Dystrophy Association. And so sometimes you'll see firefighters out in traffic. It doesn't seem wise, and you'd think, of all people, they would know better. But with their boots out to take donations to the Muscular Dystrophy Association, are they allowed already in statute to deduct the value of the time they spend on that? Or if not, why not, in your bill, expand it to include all those classes of people? And I'm sure there's others I didn't think of.
Ms. Manthey, I'm going to go to you. Possibly Mr. Michael, on what various professions get deductions for charity care? Do attorneys, do firefighters? Is there some set, or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to my knowledge, no one is allowed a deduction for services performed. It's sort of a cardinal tax policy rule that you can only take a deduction for something you've actually taken into income, and obviously if you're performing free service, that income hasn't been included in your income, and so you're not allowed to deduct it. Now, there are exemptions or deviations from that in the world of contributions of property. So, for example, if you contribute appreciated stock, even though the appreciation hasn't been taken into income, that tax policy rule is violated and you're allowed to deduct the fair market value. But so far the federal government has not gone to the step of allowing services. There has been a bill that has been introduced in Congress repeatedly that would allow similar to what Representative Grunhagen is proposing here. It just has never made it through the process. But then the focus has always been on medical professionals as a way to encourage them to provide charity care.
Chair Dappy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, Representative Grunhagen, I guess, why not expand it to lawyers and engineers and firefighters? And the plumbers routinely do, I could really get Representative Mahoney hot if I referred to him as a plumber. But the plumbers will normally do a waters on, waters off program. I'm thinking that maybe it's the Boilermakers or somebody does heats on. You know, the trades do provide services to low income households, so why not expand it to allow them to deduct the value of their work in those households, parallel to what you're proposing here for dentists and other medical professionals?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dappy. Yeah, the reason we're singling out health care here is because although many of those other activities are reputable and well intended, is because we're dealing with people's access to health care, which obviously can threaten their lives in many cases, okay? And we do have a crisis in that area. And we're going to continue to have the latest CBO report, federal CBO report on the ACA, says that even after 10 years of the Affordable Care Act, we're going to have between 29 and 31 million Americans uninsured in this country. So there's a reason to incentivize this. Also, if we can get some good upfront charity care and incentivize it, you will deal with health conditions like the constituent I had who was going to the emergency room because half his face was swelling up. Okay, so I think based on the testimony of the for the support of the MMA, Dental Association, and numerous other healthcare providers, we have a crisis in terms of access, and this goes a very short way to helping incentivize a little bit more of that for our least fortunate.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen does point out gaps in access. Now, some of my constituents would point out we could solve that much more easily in a much more straightforward and transparent way by going to a single-payer healthcare system, but I don't want to bring that up and do that to Representative Grunhagen's blood pressure. So I'm not going to mention that.
Thank you, for not even mentioning that.
Okay, I do.
Mr. Chair, much appreciated. Okay, with that, I think I've got quite a list here of members with questions, but let's get through the rest of the testifiers first. So, and then we'll go. Then I have Loeffler, Ansel, Snoblock, and then, oh no, Anderson's first. I'm sorry. Okay, please state your name and who represents for the record. And again, is there anyone that wishes to testify against this bill from the audience? Okay, please state your name and who represents for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Chuck Sawyer. I'm the Senior Vice President at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. And today I'm here both on behalf of our graduates, especially chiropractic doctors and acupuncturists, and the Minnesota Chiropractic Association, testifying in support of this bill. There are over 2,000 chiropractic doctors currently in practice across the state, and large numbers of them are practicing in rural communities where, because of Medicaid expansion and low income, a large percentage of their practices in those rural communities are made up of Medicaid and Minnesota Care patients. We are an important component of the health profession's workforce in Minnesota, and yet reimbursement for the care we provide to patients enrolled in Minnesota's public health programs is generally low, and along with our dental colleagues, often below the cost of actually providing those services in our practices. Additionally, the number and nature of the services provided by chiropractic doctors that are reimbursable is also limited. I want to give you just one notable example, and it involves reimbursement for just one annual examination, not an examination for an episode of illness or injury, but just one examination per year, and yet the follow-up exams we have to provide for patients that are under our care and returning after a period of time are necessary clinically. We're obligated to do them, and we're not reimbursed. In both instances, because we're obligated to provide those services and because of our scope of practice and the nature of the services we provide extends beyond the limited code set in Medicaid, we're providing those services, not being able to bill for them, and therefore there's a cost that's incurred especially by those doctors in rural communities. If enacted into law, House File 377 would provide at least some financial relief, as others have testified, to chiropractic doctors and other providers who care for Minnesota's lowest income individuals through this income tax deduction. With increasing numbers of Minnesotans now eligible for coverage in our public health programs, safety net programs, chiropractic doctors, medical physicians, and others are incurring more expense rendering that very necessary care that they are trained and ethically obligated to provide. We encourage you to pass this legislation.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen, that's what I have on my list. Is there anyone else?
Yeah, I have a couple other medical professionals that came today. But Eric Dick from the MMA is here. He does not have to testify, but he fully supports the bill.
Okay.
I'll give you a chance next
Thank
time.
You for being here. We appreciate that.
And then I have acupuncturist Schindler, who'd like to speak to the bill briefly.
Yeah, if we have anything new to offer, please, it hasn't already been testified to. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please,
sir. I'm Aaron Schindler. I'm a licensed acupuncturist.
How do you spell your last name?
Schindler, S-C-H-I-N-D-L-E-R.
Thank you, sir.
And I'm a licensed acupuncturist. I'm the president of the State Acupuncture Association, and I represent licensed acupuncturists. And I've been in practice for 6 years. I have a bachelor's degree in biology, a master's degree in acupuncture and oriental medicine. I think as an acupuncture practitioner, we have a personal relationship with our patients. So when they are going through a life-changing event, whether it's a divorce, a terminal illness, a single mom in college working two jobs, we often make a sacrifice to keep our patients healthy. When in many of my charity cases I've worked with, they were college students and just couldn't continue treatment. The reason so many people get acupuncture is because acupuncturists are dedicated to providing service to people who can and can't afford health care. If you look at the Pillsbury House Integrated Clinic in South Minneapolis, offering free health care to many people in their community, think of the money they're saving their community and the cost of chronic disease care down the road. Currently licensed acupuncturists contribute to both Minnesota care provider tax and sales tax. We get reimbursed by insurance, and we are regulated by the Board of Medical Practice. We are included as medical professionals under Chapter 147, and in the bill that's line 1.20. If you're thinking about any kind of health care, please include acupuncture. I'm happy to talk about charity care today, and acupuncturists do their communities a huge service in the offering many people affordable health care. And we support this bill, and we think it'll help a lot of people.
Thank you, Mr. Schindler. Let's get the gentleman from the MMA up for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Eric Dick with the Minnesota Medical Association. Very much appreciate the intent of Representative Grunhagen's bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Who else wished to? Is there Dr. Geist?
Geist, and he's going to, Mr. Chair, he's going to talk about the inner city access for the least fortunate.
Okay.
So I think it's additional testimony you haven't heard before. Hopefully briefly.
Please state your name for the
record. Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Robert Geist. I was went into practice as a specialty surgeon in urology in 1960, retired in 1997. I'm bringing you a message from Dr. Tim Rumsey, who is the director of the community clinic on West 7th Street in Randolph. And I had a nice talk with him again last night. He points out that in his clinic, about half of the people are Medicaid, and about 10%, it was his estimate, that were uninsured. This would include a lot of people who are immigrants and so forth, but the uninsured are the ones where charity care would be very appropriate. He felt, in quotes, tremendous idea. That's his direct quote for this thing. He thought this would be a great encouragement to be able to help get help with the specialty surgeons, and specialty medical people as well. So he very strongly supports this bill and would like you to do that. Now, I'd like to point out, I was a plumber, so if you have any questions, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? It will now go into questions. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen, I just appreciate you bringing this bill forward. The Mission of Mercy, which provides free dental care to individuals, was started by actually a constituent of mine, Alejandro Aguirre, who's part of the Dental Association. And they've been able to do wonderful things for people in Mankato and Bemidji and now coming here in Duluth. And they are able to address health issues that could spread to the rest of the body and cause a lot of problems for people. So appreciate their volunteer work and time in helping the citizens of Minnesota.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I think this bill was really confusing when we heard it in Health and Human Services, and it continues to be a little confusing in terms of who it's targeted at and what relief they're going to get. And the bill originally didn't have a definition of charity health care, and those of us who work in this area know there's all kinds of ways to define charity, whether you're under-reimbursed or you have bad debt because you're just not good at collecting on money that people owe you, or you don't like asking them for money, or defining who's eligible and who's served, and is it, you know, free care for your sister-in-law, does that count as charity, or is it somebody has to certify you as poor and needy? And you put a definition in that just says the commissioner should develop a definition, but they're to consider the criteria in some Minnesota rules, and I never remember or know the rules unless somebody throws them in front of me, but Representative Grunhagen, could you tell us what in on 9.110 on your A2 amendment, what is in those rules? Is that defining who's eligible or the types of services or what are we to consider in defining what is charity care?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Loeffler, for that question. Yeah, charity care is going to be defined as what's eligible under Medicaid. Okay, and that's after the last committee meeting in HHS, there was some concern that it wasn't clearly enough defined as far as the charity care services. So I had this amendment drawn up with the help of Randall Chun to clarify that it's Medicaid services only. And therefore, if it's eligible to be covered under Medicaid, it would be eligible to be deducted under charity care.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think what Representative Grunhagen, what you're saying is that the only services are that would be considered charity care are services that are covered under Medicaid. But if you're serving someone under Medicaid, it's not uncompensated care. It's you're getting paid out of Medicaid. And the question to me is, you know, this doesn't have any criteria by which we're to assemble, you know, who qualifies and who is a beneficiary of charity care, and I think that continues to be a problem. You referenced some rules that apparently, we probably don't have anyone here, I suspect, who knows the human service rules, and I don't see our staff kind of looking like they want to go look them up either. but I do think there's a real problem here in terms of knowing who we're giving relief to and what way, and I heard some of the testifiers, and I think they're just as confused as the Human Services Committee was, because they were talking about, well, they're underpaid under medical assistance. This bill doesn't fix that. It doesn't fill the gap of being underpaid. It also doesn't give you tax relief for services that you provide that Medicaid won't cover. As the chiropractor described, that they do certain things that aren't eligible for Medicaid reimbursement, and that wouldn't be eligible under this as well. And so I think there's sort of a false assumption that it's going to have more benefit than it does. But I think maybe we need Mr. Michael to kind of remind us how charitable tax deductions work. It's not a credit. So you don't get the full value. You get a portion, and it's limited to, I think, a certain percent of your taxable income. And, you know, maybe Mr. Michael could give us some sense of, you know, kind of what the range of percentages we might look at of the value of this deduction.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the itemized deduction for charitable contributions is subject, first of all, you have to be an itemizer, and it is subject to percentage limits. There's a 50%, can exceed 50% of your AGI for certain categories of contributions, or 30% of your adjusted gross income for other categories of contributions. This, though, is going to be an adjustment or a subtraction in computing Minnesota taxable income, so it would not be subject to any of those percentage restrictions. Now, as a deduction, as you point out, the benefit of this subtraction to someone who's claiming it is basically a function of multiplying the dollar amount of the subtraction that's claimed times their marginal rate. And so how much an actual tax reduction they get will depend upon the dollar amount that they claim and their marginal rate. And obviously the highest marginal rate is 9.85. So the net tax benefit can never be more than that to someone claiming this deduction. Essentially a little less than 10% of the value of the services under the Medicaid rules or the medical assistance rules that's claimed.
Representative Loughborne.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, because I think there's kind of an expectation that this is a better deal. I mean, if you think getting, you know, Medicaid reimbursements is a good is tough, this is even going to be less, and I think that there's not always a common understanding. I think it's great that we have all kinds of medical providers who do step up and provide free care to people who can't afford it, but that's not the way you deliver good health care, by having, you know, fix a smile day once a year, and the kids that are lucky enough to get their parents to even know about it and get in line, get the kids care, and the rest of the kids go home and hope maybe next year. And as opposed to getting people under insurance, and they get ongoing care and ongoing checkups, and, you know, that's what we've been really making some progress on. We do need to increase our reimbursement rates, and I quite honestly would rather see the $7 million a year in this go into the HHS reimbursement rates for all the providers and get people into continuous care as much as we can. But I do think we need to work on, if we're going to seriously consider this, Mr. Chairman, work on the definitions and look into what those rules are that it's referred to, so we know exactly who's benefiting.
Thank you, Representative Loughborne. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for those comments, Representative Loughborne. It gives me an opportunity to clarify a couple things. Number one, if you're on a public program, this does not apply. This only applies to true charity care. Number two, it doesn't affect the medical assistance rates, has been testified to previously. Okay, that's a separate issue. But it does incentivize the treatment for the uninsured or those who are not in public programs, as we heard public testimony. It's a deduction, not a credit, as you clearly stated, and I think it's good to clarify that. To give an example of what this will do, a group of dentists gave $40,000 of retail care, dental care, to the least fortunate and not on public programs, they would be able to take 26.7% of that under Medicaid as a deduction. At a 8% tax rate, that would cost the state, in terms of tax revenue, $968. So for $968 of less revenue, you're getting $40,000 worth of retail dental care for our least fortunate in our society. And I think, you know, I've even had a couple providers mention to me that if they got some type of deduction for charitable care, that they wouldn't even submit it to Medicaid. And that goes back to the fiscal note, which I'll address a little bit later, but if given the chance. But I think that's what we're talking about here, is that for, you know, $40,000, and you could do $4 million worth of retail dental care or medical care and take the same formula, and you're finding that it's a very small price the state is paying to allow access to those who are not on a public program and otherwise have difficulty getting the type of care they need to prevent health care problems that in some cases can even threaten their life. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loughborne.
That's all. Thank you.
Representative Ansels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunhagen, one of your testifiers, I can't recall which one it was, mentioned that the genesis of this legislation is to provide financial relief through the tax code to health care providers who choose to provide health care to the indigent. You know, that's a really noble goal, and developing processes that provide better care to the indigent should be a goal of all of us here. But it's the financial relief part that bothers me for the provision of uncompensated care. And again, like Representative Loeffler said, wouldn't it be better, rather than to use the tax code to provide financial relief to a cross-section or a slice of the healthcare community, wouldn't it be better to just bite the bullet, suck it up, and raise reimbursement rates for everybody so that the purpose here would be truly care for the indigent, not tax relief to very highly paid professionals in the healthcare field?
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, I think we're completely opposite on this, Representative Anselak. I see it just the opposite. I see that the current structure of government care is actually restricting the least fortunate from getting the care they need. This will actually increase access as medical professionals, especially dental, which I'm probably a little bit more familiar with, open their door because they get some type of benefit for giving charity care. I'll give you the example again of the dentist my sister works for. He just bought a practice. He cannot afford to take 10%, which is another artificial barrier to many dentists to taking medical assistance patients. He cannot afford to take 10% of his patients. He'll be out of business, all right? But he's willing to take 5 or 6%. Well, he can't do that anymore. But here, through charity care, he's going to be able to take 2, 3, 4, 5% of his patients who need care, aren't on a public program, and get some type of benefit for doing it. I'm sure he will do that. And I think there will be hundreds of other dentists and doctors and medical professionals across this state that will also do it, and they may not even turn claims into medical assistance because of the paperwork and the headache it is to get the claim paid in any form with medical assistance. And I've heard some horror stories in those particular areas.
We can share those later. Representative Anselak, okay. A follow-up?
I'm fine, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Knobloch, and then we're going to go to the department. We're going to wrap this one up.
Okay. Representative Knobloch. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Briefly, I guess listening to Mr. Michael and Representative Davney, in particular, I guess I'm thinking about dentists. I would imagine, I mean, it varies by healthcare provider, but with dentists, you've got all sorts of supplies that they buy in treating their patients. You've got bridges, you've got crowns, you've got the stuff, I don't know what they call it, that they put in your filling. I guess I don't know if one of the dental people could come up and say, I mean, what percentage of, say, the average medical assistance claim would be some sort of supplies that they're maybe buying that they're taking money out of their own pocket for to give to a patient?
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yeah, hi. Again, Lauren Tapel. I'm a dentist in Eagan. Private practice, been out there for about 25 years.
To the Knobloch question.
Yeah. Speaking to that, I mean, I can tell you that basically probably the best-run dental practices in town probably have an overhead of 65-70%. So 65-70 cents on the dollar goes to overhead, supplies, staff, whatever. We're getting reimbursed from the state on public programs about, at best, maybe 30. So doesn't quite add up. So for every 65 cents we're spending, we're getting paid 30. Okay.
Chair Knobloch.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, just to wrap it up, I guess I just was thinking about the philosophy that I guess, generally speaking, we don't allow deductions for services, but we have often allowed deductions for property that is donated. And if we've got medical providers that are donating supplies, donating property, that might be another way to think about this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings from the department, here's a resource, I believe.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I am the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spoke to Representative Grunhagen right before this about the bill and about the public policy goals that he hopes to achieve through the subtraction. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair. It's been a long discussion, and some of this has already been touched on. DOR currently has no role in calculating the rates for medical reimbursements under Minnesota Statutes 256B. You know, additional resources or competencies with the appropriate knowledge and expertise with this computation will be needed in order to try and how to establish and the claims that would be made against this subtraction. You know, federally, the value of time cannot be considered when determining charitable contributions. This would put Minnesota's tax code further out of compliance with the federal tax code, and really would mean a larger effort to try and figure out the amount of money that would be for these types of claims. Currently, the bill is limited to medical professionals, dentists, and chiropractors. This bill would treat those professions differently than other careers, such as lawyers, CPAs, business executives, construction workers, food service workers, custodial workers, who also may provide charitable services. So, Mr. Chair, we look forward to continuing this conversation through session on this bill and other important bills impacting Minnesotans.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Wrap-up, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for this hearing and for clarification and vetting this bill. Just a couple questions. On the bill, Section 1, Subdivision 19, addresses that the commissioner would have to come up with a way of documenting the value of health care for tax or taxable years. So I'll leave it at that. As far as the fiscal note is concerned, there's two ways to look at fiscal notes, static and dynamic. Static is you simply, if you cut taxes, you lose revenue. Dynamic is you may lose revenue, but what do you gain in terms of the services that are provided to those most in need? I think you'll see some medical providers not deal with medical assistance and just take a tax deduction instead. I also believe this will increase access for our least fortunate individuals in our society, and I think that's one of the things all of us, regardless of political persuasion, are concerned about. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen, to all the testifiers. Representative Wills renews her motion that House File 377 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Item next, Representative Swadzinski moves House File 764. I have one person to testify, so Representative Swadzinski, the gentleman from Lyon, if you could please present your bill. And just for some housekeeping here, I have a Mr. Mark Bruner. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify for this bill or with concerns on this bill? Seeing none, the department? No, okay. Okay, you know what that means, Representative Swadzinski.
Right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the Tax Committee. I move House File 764 be moved in front of the committee for possible inclusion into any omnibus bill that the Chair would be kind enough to include it in.
Thank you.
All right, folks, just want to talk a little bit about, you know, the modular home industry in the state of Minnesota is a completely valuable resource for our state. We have many manufacturers from across the state, have Schultz Homes, Friendship Homes, many other manufacturers within the state of Minnesota that provide a valuable service, not only job creation, but also affordable homes for sale both in the state and outside of the state. The bill before you, our intent with House File 764 is homes currently are sold under three scenarios. They're uninstalled through manufacturers and dealers. They're installed by a manufacturer, and they're installed by the dealer themselves. And so this tax bill before you is really trying to even the tax code so that no matter how consumer purchases their home, they're taxed essentially on a level playing field, and that's our intent with the bill. I brought Mark Brenner before as a testifier, and I'd be pleased if he could share some information about where we'd like to go with this bill. So, thank you.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mark Brenner, the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota.
Thank you,
Representative Swadzinski, for the introduction on the bill. Essentially, the we're addressing modular homes versus manufactured homes, just to be clear. And the difference is that a modular home is built to the state building code, although it may be built in the same plant as a manufactured home. Modular homes are always placed on a permanent foundation and are considered real property or real estate. They tend to be the homes that are the two-story, multi-section homes versus the manufactured homes, which are built to a federal building code and also the state building code. Minnesota currently has 16 plants that build modular homes. That's up from, I think it was 9 plants in 2010, and the reason we've seen the uptick isn't because the housing market's taken off for modular homes, but Minnesota's in a unique position in terms of being able to build homes for the Bakken region and the Canadian market, which has really been good for us in terms of even our existing plants have expanded, in some cases actually doubling their employment. I believe it was at the last quarter of 2012, the Department of Labor and Industry and an organization called IBC, which is involved in the in-plant inspections of our homes, calculated that Minnesota was, at that time, the largest producer in the nation of new modular homes. I'm not sure where we stand exactly today, but it's become a critical part of many communities in the state in terms of the number of plants. And as we see the market shifting a little bit in terms of demand in the western states and Canada, we'd like to, what the bill does is just clarify how modular homes are currently taxed in terms of sales tax. In one scenario, the builder of a modular home that works with the actual home buyer or the consumer, and they purchase the home from the builder, and then the builder puts the home on the foundation and does all the work. In that case, the home would pay sales tax on materials only, because the builder obviously knows exactly what the cost of the materials are. So in that situation, they would only pay sales tax on the actual cost of the materials. The other scenarios are a little different. In a situation where a dealer or a licensed sales center sells a modular home, the consumer would end up paying sales tax on the invoice amount, the dealer's cost of the home, so that you're paying full sales tax on the dealer's actual cost of the home. Another scenario would be if the consumer actually did the work themselves, or the home buyer, and the sales center wasn't in the process, then they would end up paying sales tax on the full sales price of the home. What the bill does is just try to clarify how all that works, in that it would allow for the manufacturer or the builder of the home to still charge sales tax on materials only, but they could also subcontract. In other words, if they don't have their own contract team or contractors inside to do the work, they could subcontract and still then pay sales tax on the materials only. In the other scenarios where they'd previously been paying tax based on the dealer's cost of the home, or the full sales price of the home, it would equalize out to paying on 65% of the invoice cost of the home or the dealer's cost, and 65% is based on a sales tax rate that's in current statute for manufactured homes. And essentially what that does is it's the best estimate, frankly should probably be a little lower, but to back out labor costs, so that the homeowner isn't paying sales tax on labor as you don't on a site-built home, and you don't on a modular home when you're buying it directly from the manufacturer. So that's really what the bill does, is just try to lend some clarity, some balance to how sales tax is calculated for modular homes.
Questions for members? Okay, thank you very much. You want to renew your motion, Representative, the gentleman from Lyon?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move that House File 764 be placed before the committee and for possible inclusion in the next omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Item next, we will go to House File 53, as we have some folks from out of town to testify on this one. So I'll move House File 53 until it is before us. Is Mr. John Dukic here? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Dukic, I'm with the Minnesota High Tech Association. I also staff the chair of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, Margaret Anderson Kelleher. Unfortunately, she can't be here today, but you will find a letter in your packet from her in support of House File 53. The Minnesota High Tech Association represents more than 300 science and technology companies and organizations from across the state with the goal of helping make Minnesota a top five technology state. Expanding access to broadband is a crucial component to achieving this goal and helping make Minnesota more economically competitive. So making the sales tax exemption for telecommunications equipment permanent will provide certainty to broadband providers and enable more thoughtful, future-oriented investment planning. With this in mind, we encourage your support for House File 53. Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of this bill? Please come forward. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns thereof? The Department of Revenue, any testimony? No testimony from the department. Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Todd Raisler. I'm CEO of Ascentec. We cover approximately a 400-square-mile area in southeastern Minnesota. We are currently in a 7 to 10 year build-out of fiber to the home in our area. This last year, we paid approximately $41,000 in sales tax in 2014. Of course, if that sales tax could have been used for fiber, that pays for in excess of two to nearly 3 miles worth of fiber. So to me, it seems that paying that sales tax is counterproductive to what everyone in this room is looking for in terms of technology in the state of Minnesota and the rural areas.
Thank you. I do have some Spring Grove pop up in my fridge for afterwards. He's a constituent, so you got it. Any questions for Mr. Raisler? Or why don't we get Mr. who just testified with the High Tech Association? And you said the former speaker's with me on this one?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, can you repeat that?
You said the former speaker's with me on this one?
That's right. That's correct. She represents, she's the chair of the Governor's Broadband Task Force and the president of the Minnesota High Tech Association. We're on board.
Who am I to disagree with the former speaker? Okay, any questions for either of the testifiers? Well, thank you very much. We've got
thank
grape,
you very
strawberry,
much.
And the new rhubarb. It's
thank
very,
you very much,
it's
Mr.
delicious.
Chairman.
Okay, with that, I will renew my motion that House File 53 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Okay, item last is House File 1005. This is the perennial bill that we have, and I do owe a thanks to Chair Lencheski for including this in the bill last year. There's quite a history on this. For many years, members, we had reciprocity with three states. That means if you live in one state, work in the other. Well, I'll have Mr. Michael describe exactly what it is in more detail. But we have it currently with North Dakota, I believe, and staff, correct me if I'm wrong here, Michigan, because the folks up in northeastern Minnesota, some of them actually work in Michigan. You wouldn't think of that up on the UP there. And for years, we had it with Wisconsin. Some time ago, Wisconsin was a little bit late in paying some of their bills, and Governor Pawlenty, with some tough budget situations, basically canceled it, let it go. And since then, of course, I've been trying to get it back. And just right up front, it affects my district. Houston County has more people negatively affected by lack of reciprocity than any county in the state. When you have the situation of the Twin Cities, you have more folks coming in from Wisconsin to the Twin Cities than Twin Cities to Wisconsin. There's also a great effect in Duluth, Superior. But in that case, again, you have a lot of the Superior folks coming over to Duluth. In my case, the regional centers on the other side of the river, La Crosse, so you have La Crosse and Caledonia folks that live in District 28B. They work in La Crosse that are negatively impacted by this. So then as we try to bring it back in the 2011 tax bill that the governor signed, directed the commissioner, Franz at the time, to negotiate with Wisconsin. We had summits and we had meetings and all this stuff, and it never happened. The situation, and again, I think Chair Lencheski, we put it again in with some actual money to try and get this thing going the 14 tax bill. And so far, we're not moving forward there. And I also would like to thank Commissioner Bowerly for her time that she has spent on this issue. It's a complicated issue. It really is, and she's working with Secretary Chandler over in Wisconsin, and hopefully we can get this through. Now, the bill as submitted is probably a little too rich, goes a little too far. I've been talking to Commissioner Bowerly on this, and maybe Mr. Cummings, if you could join us, and maybe give a brief history from the department's perspective. We've had several laws passed to re-enter into this agreement. We have not had anything signed at this point. And this is one where, you know, I think the Day administration has put good efforts forward, and it just hasn't come through yet. So with that, maybe you can make a few comments and then follow up maybe Ms. Manzi or Mr. Michael. And then it would be my intention to lay this bill over. And I talked to Commissioner Bowerly, there would be a lot of changes from, just so you know, from the way it is right now. So, Mr. Cummings, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chair, and we do appreciate those comments. As you know, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Bowerly spoke to you last night about this bill and about the issue of tax filing on Minnesota's eastern border. So, Mr. Chair, I hesitate to provide any background to you about the history of reciprocity, as I know you know it very well. But if I may, Mr. Chair, be a resource to the non-reciprocity-versed members of our audience. Income tax reciprocity allows residents who live in one state but work in another to file the income tax return in their home state. And so maybe I'll just fill in a few gaps about the history. For 40 years, tax years 1968 through 2009, Minnesota and Wisconsin had an income tax reciprocity agreement. In 2002, Minnesota's Governor Jesse Ventura proposed termination of the agreement because of the negative impact of the timing of the payment on Minnesota's revenue and also a dispute over the calculation of the payment. That agreement was not terminated, but Minnesota statute was amended to require that the payment include interest as a condition of retaining the agreement. But really, Mr. Chair, it hit a breaking point in 2009, as you mentioned. Governor Pawlenty was concerned about the need to wait 15 months for a reciprocity payment to be received. Because of that, the Commissioner Ward Innes at the time terminated the agreement in September of 2009 for tax years starting in 2010.
So Mr. Cummings, Mr. Innes did that?
Yeah, that's right.
I'll have to talk to him. Mr. Cummings.
So although the payment for tax year 2009, the last year the agreement, was due in December of 2010, Wisconsin did not make that payment until July of 2011. A 2011 law required the Commissioner of Revenue to initiate negotiations with the Wisconsin Secretary of Revenue with the objective of entering into a new agreement. That was something that you worked on, Mr. Chair. Negotiations were initiated, but it was determined that there was not enough lead time to finalize the agreement to be in place by January of 2012. Negotiations then proceeded with the goal of an agreement beginning in tax year 2013, but no agreement was reached. In 2014, the Minnesota legislature authorized Minnesota to enter into a reciprocity agreement beginning in tax year 15 with That law would allow Wisconsin to pay $1 million less per year than to Minnesota than Wisconsin would have paid had it accepted either of our previous two offers in 12 and 13. So that authorization ended on September 30th of 2014. So in accordance with that law, Commissioner Franz sent a proposal in June of last year to the Wisconsin to restore reciprocity, and then we received a response from Secretary Chandler that restates their previous offer and does not offer any reimbursement of Minnesota's revenue loss. Mr. Chair, a lot has been asked about what is reciprocity. So reciprocity is an exception to the general rule of how personal service income is allocated by state. So let's just talk about the general rule for a second. For a resident, the general rule is that all income is subject to tax in the state of residence, and then a non-refundable credit is allowed for tax paid to another state on the same income. For a non-resident, the general rule is that wage and other personal service income is subject to tax in the state in which it is earned. So I think here's the sort of crux of what everything's going on. If two states have an income tax reciprocity agreement, wage and other personal service income is not subject to tax in the state in which it is earned. The income is subject to tax only in the state of residence, and no credit is claimed for tax paid to the other state. Without reciprocity, then, a taxpayer pays in total the higher of the tax of the state of employment or the state of residence. With reciprocity, the taxpayer pays the tax in just the state of residence. Statute provides that a reciprocity agreement between Minnesota and Wisconsin must include a reimbursement payment equal to Minnesota's net revenue loss. Minnesota's net revenue loss is the revenue that Minnesota will lose under reciprocity from not being able to tax Wisconsin residents on their Minnesota personal service income, less the credit that Minnesota residents would no longer claim for tax paid to Wisconsin. So under the previous agreement and under Wisconsin's current proposal, the offset would not be the Minnesota credit, but would be the Minnesota tax paid by Minnesota residents on their personal service income. A talking point that has been brought up a lot is that Wisconsin does have lower statutory rates for the middle class. But they also have smaller personal and dependent exemptions, along with lower standard and itemized deductions. That means Wisconsin has a higher effective income tax rate for middle-income workers. Because the Wisconsin tax is higher than the Minnesota tax for most taxpayers, Wisconsin's position results in a lower reimbursement payment to Minnesota, which is what we're talking about today, Mr. Chair. Overall, under the bill, Minnesotans would be expected to subsidize Wisconsin's higher effective income taxes on middle-income workers for a little over $5 million per year. A reciprocity agreement with Wisconsin would allow 80,000 taxpayers the convenience of filing their income tax return in only their home state. So of those, 24,000 are Minnesota residents, and approximately 56,000 are Wisconsin residents. The proposed agreement in this bill would result in less withholding for the state in which the worker is earning the money, which is disproportionately Minnesota, as many Wisconsinites work in Minnesota, and only some Minnesotans work in Wisconsin. And I know that for you, Mr. Chair, in your district, that might be the inverse. But for most of Minnesota, many Wisconsinites work in Minnesota, and then some just work in Wisconsin. So thus, we have a significant payment of the amount of tax to Minnesota from Wisconsin. That revenue estimate shows that this payment is estimated to be between $90 million and $100 million per year. And I was talking to Dr. Wilson, and he said that the only two agreements that he can think of in which there's this large imbalance in which there are payments made is the Wisconsin the former Wisconsin agreement with Minnesota, and then the current Wisconsin agreement with Illinois. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource. I understand that this bill is a work in progress. We do have comments on the bill, but In deference to the conversation you had with Commissioner Bowerly, we really work to hope to continue to work with you on this draft to make it the best possible arrangement for Minnesotans.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cummings. And this is an issue where we have to make it so that it works for the Commissioner of Revenue. I mean, we have to get there, and it's my intention to work very hard to do that. It seems to me that if we changed one word in the agreements with Wisconsin and we just said effective, we'd be okay.
Well, we'll look. We will look back on that. We have a long ways to go, and we are committed to try and thinking outside the box to what is something that we can try and do something to make sure that Minnesota's net revenue loss is compensated for, but is protecting the taxpayers of Minnesota.
Mr. Cummings, when does the Wisconsin-Illinois agreement have to renew, or is that just in perpetuity until one state backs out? Because that's a lot bigger deal than this.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, but I can check on that.
Okay, let's look at that. Okay, we've got some questions here, and first of all, I apologize to members from Central Minnesota. Because when I talk to members from Central Minnesota and we talk tax reciprocity, they say, what is that? And they would really have no reason to know what it is. And so I thank the committee for their indulgence. I know it affects a few folks around here, like Representative Drazkowski and, certainly Representative Barrett, and there are others. So any border legislator, you're okay if you're bordering North Dakota or you're further up northeast where you have the Michigan issue, but in the southeast and, anybody that borders Wisconsin, Duluth, down to the cities, and like I said, I get hit, in full disclosure, I get hit very hard because it's just the inverse of what it is across most of the rest of the state. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can appreciate how much of a hassle this is for the people who are affected. A lot of times we can work these things out, but to work it out, you have to have a partner on the other side of the deal who's willing to be honorable and reliable. And, our past experience hasn't been all that great. And I'll just say, given this particular moment in time, I quite honestly wouldn't bet on them being a reliable partner. I just read recently about how, Wisconsin's in a very different circumstance than we are. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's facing a $283 million deficit that he has to resolve by June. So they're back into slash and burn like we've experienced in the past and thankfully have, through I think some good fiscal policies, gotten ourselves out of. But I also just read that they have some short-term debt that's due in May that they're not intending to pay as part of that solution. And so if they're in a situation of, apparently the debt was written in a way that allows them to seek this with some penalties on interest. So they're not like actually violating their bonds as I understand it. But they are intending to dramatically increase their borrowing costs and in order to improve themselves, probably not very creditworthy in the future. And if they're doing that with, bondholders and investors, I don't know if they're going to think Minnesota is on the most favored creditor list if we were to enter into an agreement. So I think we really have to evaluate the partnership when we're entering into these things. And unfortunately, I don't think they're in a situation right now that makes it very easy for them to work on these things.
Well, and thank you. Points well taken, Representative Loeffler, and if it was easy, it wouldn't be before the Tax Committee. We would have done it by now. And this is a situation, it's very interesting. It's actually refreshing in a way to be able to work so bipartisanly because, in the past they've said, Dayton did this or Dayton did that. And I say, no, Dayton didn't do that, and he didn't do this. His administration has worked very hard on this issue, and I commend them for that. Then I get in trouble right before the election because I said nice things about a Democrat. I get all that. That's fine. But we have to be honest about this, and it's been one that the department has worked on for a long time, and it's a tough issue. And with Wisconsin's situation now, but just remember, never underestimate my sneakiness, sneaky, because there are things, as I don't know if you caught what Mr. Cummings said, thinking outside the box a bit. So I'm just not going to let this one go. It may not be in the traditional fashion of the way we've done in the past. And then, of course, you bring in the whole Illinois thing, because and that's a whole other thing that could really go awry possibly. So this is an issue, and again, I thank the committee for their indulgence on this, because for most of you, it just doesn't register. But it sure does with the folks I represent, and there's quite a history here we've had. And I was going to go to Mr. Mike or Ms. Manzi, but I think Mr. Cummings kind of pretty much hit it pretty well, didn't he? Do you have anything to add, or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, no, I think Mr. Cummings summed it up very well. I think maybe restating it in a slightly different way may sharpen the issue a bit. And I think one way to think about this is that putting in place a reciprocity agreement results in a fair group of Minnesota taxpayers who will pay lower taxes as a result of this, and that's because they will be relieved of paying Wisconsin's higher taxes on middle-income workers, the way Mr. Cummings pointed out. So the crux of the issue here is Wisconsin says, we don't want to pay for giving a tax cut to Minnesota residents. We want to be reimbursed for our full cost of reciprocity. Mm-hmm. Minnesota, by contrast, says, we don't want to pay for part of Wisconsin's budget, which is what those taxpayers would have been paying in those higher taxes. Wisconsin ought to pay for that. And so there's the rub. And so, honestly, and the rub is $5 million some dollars.
Right.
And so somehow the two states have to figure out how you're going to split that up. At least that's my view of the essential element of the dispute.
And Mr. Michael, when you're describing that, Minnesotans paying because Wisconsin has a higher effective rate.
That's right.
If you just look, that's a very big word here. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Michael summed it up perfectly. And, you know, we've had a long history in the state with reciprocity going back and forth. And I think on the one hand, this is something that I think the Dayton administration has worked really hard to make sure that this has been restored. We also find this to be something that is out of the norm now. New reciprocity agreements have not been entered into, with other states for a very long time. This is decades. Many of the reciprocity agreements that when this was sort of in vogue was decades ago. And so this is what the Dayton administration has done in partnership with the legislature in trying to restore this is something odd. Like I said, Mr. Chair, we're looking at this, and we're just trying to see what we can do. You mentioned, Mr. Chair, that Commissioner Bowerly spoke to Secretary Chandler, I believe, last week, and they had a lengthy conversation about how can we move forward, and what are the things that are holding us back, and I know that. This $5 million difference was making sure that we're not putting our state at risk either by the annual payments, but also by what the calculation is, was something that they talked about. Obviously, that number changes over time, too. And so we would want to make sure that this calculation is dynamic over time so that if that $5 million difference balloons to $15 million or $25 million, that we're not putting ourselves into a situation in which that would be worse. I know we're also hoping that Wisconsin would provide a $100 million check every year as well. That's another big part of this. I know the bottom line tends to be $5 million. That's a difference, but it's a $100 million check that's also
per month?
Right. That would be per year, Mr. Chair.
Oh, per year. Okay. I'd also like to thank Mr. Michael and staff at House Research for drafting this. The way this is drafted, if you read it, it kind of takes care of everything. But there's some things that the department and I will be and others will be talking about to make this work. And, for example, Offler, your comments very well taken. And then that's what we're up against. So any other, Mr. Cummings, any other thoughts or questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other questions from members to either the author, Mr. Cummings, or House Research? Okay, so I will move that House File 1005 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Tax Bill. Any other comments from members to go to the order? Seeing none or hearing none, good government all the time, we are adjourned.